This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
At Brown Paper Tickets, seating is limited. 100% of ticket sales go to KBOO for this benefit spectacular. See events under the KBOO website for February 14th, Valentine's Day. See you there.
This is Rachel and Justin from Music from the True Vine inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs.
We'll be joined by our fellow Music from the True Vine hosts as the True Vine Ramblers performing a set of traditional bluegrass. Our special guests will be Deanne Nelson and Jim Seafeld.
Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddling friends putting the bow to some old-time fiddle tunes, and Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing Western Swing.
Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m.
Doors open at 6 o'clock p.m. Plan on arriving early as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea.
For event and ticket price details, go to kboo.fm/boomoon2013.
Once in a Boo Moon is a benefit for your community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of demonstrators gather in downtown Portland to take part in a rally and march to end violence against women worldwide.
Two U.S. lawmakers introduce comprehensive climate change legislation to the Senate floor.
And the hunger strike of a Palestinian prisoner stretches into its sixth month with little notice from U.S. media. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 14th, 2013. I'm Andrew Geller.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Domestic violence doesn't take a day off for Valentine's Day. Last year, more than 40 Oregon women were killed by their domestic partners. The groups that provide emergency shelter and services want more state funding to expand their reach. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO reporter Quinn Reed has more.
Valentine's Day doesn't mean hearts, flowers, and candy when you're in an abusive relationship. This is also Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month. And in Oregon, the groups that provide shelter and services to people fleeing abuse say they can't focus on prevention for young people when they're barely able to serve the domestic violence victims in crisis. The Oregon Coalition on Domestic and Sexual Violence says the shelter system receives less than half of what is considered the minimum necessary funding for emergency services. Its director, Vanessa Timmons, says the immediate goal is more state money from lawmakers.
What I'm hearing from them is, we get it, but right now that it's an uphill climb. But what I say is, you know, domestic and sexual violence services have been underfunded historically in our state for so long. We can't afford to not make this shift.
Timmons says her group is also advocating for several bills in the legislature. They include authorizing a statewide study of teen dating violence and setting up a fund for prevention activities. Carrie Naughton heads the Crime Survivors Program for the Partnership for Safety and Justice. She says Oregon's criminal justice system is focused on locking people up instead of getting at the root causes of the problems that often lead to abuse. She thinks there are better things to spend tax dollars on than more prison beds.
That frees up a lot of money that can be reinvested into other parts of the public safety system that have seen their funding go either unfunded or cut for so long, like victim services, like state troopers, like community corrections.
Last year, more than 40 women killed in Oregon were domestic violence victims. And the shelter system receives 175,000 annual requests for emergency lodging and services. A national study from Johns Hopkins University found that being able to access those services reduces the risk of reassault by up to 70%. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, this is Quinn Reed with KBOO News.
Today, the president of the National Congress of American Indians urged the House of Representatives to pass the Violence Against Women Act. The act, which expired in 2011, has been credited for reducing occurrences of domestic violence. The Violence Against Women Act has special importance for American Indians because it would allow tribal courts to prosecute and sentence non-Indians who commit violence against Native women on tribal lands. According to the president of the National Congress of American Indians, nearly 60% of Native American women are married to non-Native men. A report issued by the Department of Justice in 2000 indicated that American Indian women are 2.5 times more likely to be raped than non-Native women. Currently, suspects in these types of crimes cannot be prosecuted in tribal courts. House Republicans are in the process of drafting their own version of the bill because they say that the current version would endanger the civil liberties of non-Indian defendants. Vice President Joe Biden, who was the chief author of the original bill in 1994, is urging quick passage because women are being killed by their husbands, boyfriends, and unknown men every day. American Indian leaders are urging Congress to treat tribes like any government by allowing them to protect their own people.
Today, an event called 1 Billion Rising has taken place all over the world. 1 Billion Rising is a global call of action to end violence against women and girls and demand an end to rape culture. Actions called for include a global strike, dances, marches, and workshops. 5,000 actions in 160 countries aim to highlight a UN statistic showing that 1 in 3 women will be raped or beaten in her lifetime. Actions planned by 1 Billion Rising PDX include a rally at 3 p.m. at Directors Park in downtown Portland, followed by a march. The march will lead to the First Unitarian Church at 1211 Southwest Main Street for dancing, speakers, workshops, tabling, breakout sessions, and more. Events at the church are expected to go on until 7:10 p.m. tonight. KB reporter Joe Lino spoke with lead organizers for 1 Billion Rising and Idle No More just before the rally began for more information.
All right, right now I'm standing at Director Park just before the rally is about to begin. The crowd here is easily 500 strong and growing by the minute. I'm standing here with Kelly Caldwell.
Good afternoon. We're excited to be here.
Could you please tell us a little bit about 1 Billion Rising?
1 Billion Rising is an effort organized by women around the world in solidarity to address and end the issues of violence against women. We're concerned at a global level and also locally with issues of trafficking, unequal access to resources for a variety of types of women.
Could you tell me a little bit about the events planned today?
We're at Directors Park right now. We're going to be having our events opened up with a drum circle by Idle No More. We'll be hearing a little bit more about that. Then we're going to be doing some flash mob dancing and marching, ending up at 1211 Southwest Main, which is the First Unitarian Church, where there's going to be more workshops and activities. Idle No More is also having activities at the PSU Native Center.
We have someone from Idle No More here, and your name is?
Elizabeth LaPonte.
And Elizabeth, can you please tell me what Idle No More, their role in the 1 Billion Rising, in conjunction with them, what y'all have been doing and what we can expect today?
So Jalene Joseph organized this as a gathering in solidarity with 1 Billion Rising. We're here for Idle No More, but we're here for Indigenous women worldwide. There's much violence, both from non-Indigenous individuals towards Indigenous women, a number of murdered and missing women who we are here standing for, as well as a lot of internal violence that is an effect of colonization, generations of hurt and pain that has been passed down. So we stand here today in Portland, Oregon, in the hopes of standing in solidarity with a number of other events happening across the world right now on February 14th in the name of our Indigenous women, for ourselves and for our own healing and for our next generations.
There's 205 countries where women and their male supporters are gathering today, and today is not the end. We're going to keep rising.
That was Joe Lino speaking with Kelly Caldwell, a 1 Billion Rising organizer, and Elizabeth LaPonte with Idle No More. Now Joe joins us live on the line for an update from today's actions. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Jen.
Thank you for joining us. Can you describe the current scene for us, Joe, and
Absolutely.
How it's developed since we last heard from you?
Yes, right now I'm standing in the intersection of Southwest Main and Southwest 12th, where the march is just about to reach its ultimate destination at the First Unitarian Church. Earlier today at Director's Park, there were some speeches, and as reported, I Don't Know More was there, and they gave they performed speeches and a circle dance, a ceremonial circle dance, that incorporated eventually the whole crowd. After that, they marched through downtown. They went north down 10th to south on Burnside and then up Broadway, where they everyone met at Pioneer Square, where there were more dances. It became a dance party, and as you can hear behind me, it's a celebratory mood, along with the important message they're bringing.
Absolutely. And what would you roughly put attendance at this moment?
At this moment, I'd say it's gone down to about 300. At the peak of it, there were a good 800 strong easily. And with a lot of crowds lined up, giving a lot of support. And I did want to mention that unlike a lot of other marches through the streets, the police presence has been very hands-off on this one. Just nothing but foot patrols visible, and very few of them at all.
I see, and that was what I was going to ask you about. You know, I understand that this march lacks a permit and that was an intentional choice. Has that played out in any tangible way?
Not at all. In fact, right before that, they did make that announcement, and they did send a message to the police in the crowd to say this was not an act of disrespect, just that women have been put in a position where they need to ask for permission for anything. And so they felt that it was a symbolic gesture to not ask for permission on this.
All right. And what are the plans for the rest of the evening from this point on?
Right now, like I said, we just arrived at First Unitarian Church, and there's various workshops. The first one's going to be a workshop from the Sexual Assault Resource Center. That's going to move into other workshops such as Women's Strength Workshop and a workshop about teen dating violence and the House bill that's before the state legislature right now. And it looks like it's going to end up with a lecture, The Root of Women's Oppression and How to End It.
All right. And just before we go, Joe, can you remind us quickly of the location of the First Unitarian Church in case any listeners are caring to join?
Yes, the church is located at 1211 Southwest Main Street, First Unitarian Church downtown.
All right, terrific. Thank you for joining us, Joe.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with KBOO's Joe Lino, who's been a reporter on the scene of Portland's 1 Billion Rising action this afternoon and evening.
Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber, along with a number of business groups, joined together this week to support House Bill 2787, allowing undocumented youth to attend state-run universities at in-state tuition rates. The governor sees this action as good for Oregon's economy, and he endorses advanced education as key to the long-term economic success of both individuals and the state. Kitzhaber sees those young people who work hard, go to school, get good grades, and graduate as the type of students who are needed in our public universities and community colleges. House Bill 2787 details the conditions for students who lack the necessary immigration documents to qualify for in-state tuition. Requirements include attending a U.S. school for 5 years, an Oregon school for 3 years, and graduating from an Oregon high school or equivalent. It also specifies filing affidavits with the selected institution declaring the student is seeking legal immigration status in the United States. The bill does not grant financial aid or free education, but will place tuition more in the realm of affordability. 12 other states, including California and Washington, have similar laws. The Oregon Senate passed similar bills in 2003 and 2011, but both bills failed to secure full passage. The governor is hoping the outcome will be different this time.
Three Oregon state senators are supporting legislation that will protect the privacy of people using Facebook and other social media sites. Republican Senators Bruce Starr, Betsy Close, and Jim Knopp are backing a measure that will ban employers and schools from forcing applicants to provide passwords for their social media and or email accounts. Representative Starr sees social networking as blurring the line between public and private, potentially interfering with personal privacy. He is hopeful that this bill will set boundaries to protect the rights of individuals to personal privacy. The proposed legislation will not interfere with traditional background checks, which are fundamental to the hiring process, nor prohibit employers from viewing the public portions of social media accounts.
Telecom giant AT&T and the Federal Communications Commission have found themselves at odds lately over a petition by AT&T to upgrade their technology. AT&T is seeking FCC approval to transition to all Internet Protocol networks from more traditional circuit-switched services. According to critics and consumer protection advocates, with this change would come the removal of all kinds of regulatory oversight. They say the changes could mean higher prices and lessened access, particularly for underserved consumers. A recent post on the AT&T public policy blog complained that the FCC was not moving fast enough on AT&T's petition. For more information, KBOO's Jen Chavez spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of media and technology reform advocacy group Free Press.
What sort of regulatory changes is AT&T seeking with their petition to the FCC?
What's happening is that AT&T is trying to seize upon a technological transition, the movement from old-fashioned copper wires to the new fiber optics, the Internet Protocol technology. They're trying to seize on that technology change in order to get rid of a lot of consumer protections and other regulations that have always been part of our telecommunications system. And our concern is that while the technology may change, the need to protect consumers from things like price gouging, to make sure service is available to everyone, to make sure these companies have responsibilities at times of emergency, that hasn't changed. And yet the way AT&T is pushing forward with this petition very much seems designed to relieve them of any obligations to serve the public interest, and we think that should be of major concern.
And why are IP networks so much less regulated than traditional circuit-switched services?
Well, so they're not yet. They are not yet so much less regulated, but AT&T is attempting to seize upon, you know, what at a certain level seems sort of logical. Oh, new technology, we need something different to get rid of these obligations.
I see.
But there's no reason to do it. Past technological changes have still held public obligations.
You mentioned rate protections and price gouging. What sort of consumers would be the most affected by changes in price of services?
Well, certainly the people who will feel these kind of changes most immediately are low-income and older consumers who, of course, both tend to be on a more limited budget, but also often are much more reliant on that landline. They don't have all of the super high-speed connections. People living in areas that aren't yet served by high-speed internet providers, they're going to be vulnerable. People who really just want a landline into their home are going to be upsold by these companies if they don't have these obligations and pressured and forced to buy higher and more expensive services.
And what sort of implication would this have in terms of competition between businesses or jobs?
Well, I think it has real concerns when it comes to jobs, because part of what AT&T wants to get out of is maintaining certain kinds of services, certain kinds of systems. I think those employ a lot of people. I think we have very good reason to be very worried about competition, that AT&T will be freer to raise rates on others who might be using their lines to provide services, and that in general this is part of an attempt by the AT&Ts and Verizons and the big cable companies for sort of a race to the bottom where they get rid of their obligations to consumers, where they target only the highest wealth customers, and where the rest of us really get left behind.
How would you characterize AT&T's interactions with and behavior towards the FCC since the appearance of their recent petition?
My impression is that what AT&T is really trying to do is bully the agency. You know, they've got all these presentations and talking points. They're beginning to mobilize the usual suspects among groups who tend to endorse what AT&T does, groups that AT&T supports financially. And we're seeing them, for example, the senior vice president of AT&T today published a blog post really pushing the FCC, claiming that they were delaying getting rid of outdated regulations, when what we need our federal regulators to do is actually weigh the impact of these kind of changes and be very careful about what kind of regulations it gets rid of to make sure they understand the implications for the consumer, not just for the big companies like AT&T.
I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, the president and CEO of Free Press. More information can be found at freepress.net. This has been Jen Chavez reporting for KBOO News. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. And be sure to join your favorite KBOO hosts this evening at the Clinton Street Theater for a KBOO benefit showing of Alfred Hitchcock's movie Rear Window at 7 p.m. tonight. Tomorrow's weather will start out foggy and mostly cloudy, but should gradually become sunny and reach a high near 56 degrees.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you fool with Mother Nature, she'll most likely fool with you, usually in very unpleasant ways. Monsanto, the biotech profiteer, keeps rediscovering this reality, but never seems to learn from it. For more than a decade, it has aggressively pushed its genetically altered corn and soybean seeds on American farmers. Called Roundup Ready, the seeds have had their genes altered specifically so the resulting corn plants and soybeans can tolerate heavier doses of an herbicide called Roundup. Who makes this weed killer? Monsanto. So its Frankenseeds are really nothing but a marketing scheme to sell and spread more pesticide. But Roundup kills those pesky weeds, so farmers gain, right? Wrong. Monsanto's bio-tampering fooled Mother Nature briefly, but Mom has fought back. Several weeds have mutated to become immune to Roundup. For farmers, coping with these new super weeds has already become a billion-dollar-a-year nightmare, and they're spreading like, well, like super weeds. As reported by Tom Philpott of MotherJones.com, a 31-state survey of farmers found that half of them now have Roundup-immune weeds in their fields. Some states are especially hard hit. Infested acreage doubled in Iowa, Indiana, and Nebraska last year, and 92% of Georgia farmers say they now have the weeds. But Monsanto, having learned nothing, is peddling yet another bio-scheme to fool Mother Nature. Called Next Generation, these are re-altered seeds that let farmers dump super-toxic pesticides on the super-weeds. This is Jim Hightower saying, great, let's spread more poisonous and more costly poisons on our food. Then Mother Nature will evolve and proliferate even more super-super-weeds. As organic and sustainable farmers are showing, it's far better to cooperate with Mother Nature than foolishly trying to sledgehammer her.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The most comprehensive climate change legislation to date was introduced in Washington today. Senators Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Barbara Boxer of California presented their proposal to the Senate, outlining two separate acts, the Climate Protection Act and the Sustainable Energy Act. For more on these bills, KBOO's Stephen Sherritt spoke to Marty Hayden from nonprofit public interest law firm Earth Justice.
So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the legislation that was introduced today by Senators Sanders and Boxer.
Sure. The Sanders-Boxer bill that was dropped today, it was a couple of bills. First and foremost, it sets a fee on carbon. of $20 a ton that'll rise over a 10-year period that's expected to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by 2025. In addition, it eliminates all fossil fuel subsidies for coal, oil, natural gas. That's going to generate about $113 billion in revenue by closing those loopholes. It invests in energy efficiency and sustainable energy, and protects communities from the practice of fracking by two most important things. It closes what's known as the Halliburton loophole, where fracking in the pollutants that are put into people's water are exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act. So this bill puts that back under the Safe Drinking Water Act, and it forces companies to disclose the chemicals that they use in their fracking processes. As part of the fee, they take 3/5 of the revenue that comes in the fee and rebate that back to every legal U.S. resident. So that way the big oil and company can't just stick it to the consumer. So families and individuals will receive 3/5 of the fee that is collected to help with their bills.
Can you talk about how this legislation compares to other climate change legislations that have been passed?
Yeah, well, this is a carbon fee that's been paid. That's per ton of carbon you pay a fee. The other legislation actually set up a targeted reduction over time of carbon, and then set up a system of credits that you would then could acquire and buy to pay to meet that emission reduction target. It's called, and you could trade those credits, so it's called a cap and trade system. Frankly, the cap and trade system is much more complex than this. This is more a carbon fee is a more straightforward approach.
What sorts of opposition do you expect this legislation to face?
Oh, I think big oil and King Coal are going to hate it.
I see. In what ways is Earth Justice supporting the legislation that was just introduced today?
Senator Boxer said she hopes to bring the bill, to pass the bill out of her committee, and will obviously be working to, help line up the votes to get its passage out of the committee and then to push for it when it goes to the full Senate floor.
Right on. Well, I guess that's all the questions I really had. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, Sanders and Boxer deserve a lot of credit for stepping up to the plate and heeding the president's call from the State of the Union address to take serious action on climate now. Most Americans know climate change is here and affecting us today. It's costing, it's costing the nation billions of dollars in drought and fires and severe storms each year right now. The longer we put off doing something serious about this, the more those impacts are going to be and the more expensive those impacts are going to be.
That was Marty Hayden with Earth Justice, and my name is Stephen Sherritt with KBOO News.
The Guardian newspaper reports that conservative billionaires have anonymously donated nearly $120 million to groups working to discredit climate change science. Two Washington, D.C. funds, Donors Trust and Donors Capital Fund, collected and distributed these donations after assuring the donors that none of the money would go to liberal groups. The donors supplied a steady stream of funding to conservative think tanks, researchers, documentary producers, policy forums, and activist groups, casting doubt about the science behind climate change. The anti-climate change movement and the flow of money to it has significantly picked up pace. In 2002, the two trusts raised less than $1 million for their cause, whereas by 2010, The two trusts were channeling nearly $30 million to conservative organizations opposing climate action or science.
Cloud Peak Energy, a Wyoming coal company, has struck option agreements with two proposed coal terminals in Washington. The deal with the proposed Gateway Pacific Terminal in Cherry Point, north of Seattle, allows the company to ship up to 16 million tons of coal per year through the port when it goes operational in 2018. A separate deal with Millennium Bulk Terminal in Longview allows the company to ship an additional 5 million tons of coal. Cloud Peak is among many U.S. coal companies seeking to expand their access to the Asian market amid shrinking business at home. Northwest, as well as national environmental groups, have stridently opposed the development of both terminals. They say that both proposals would contribute to climate change, both in their operations and by simply playing a role in the expansion of the market for U.S. coal. Some Portland residents have also opposed the terminals, fearing an increase in dusty coal trains moving throughout the area.
The Albany and Eastern Railroad Company has filed a grievance in U.S. District Court in Eugene, Oregon, according to the Albany Democrat Herald. Teven Brothers Land and Timber Company runs a logging mill east of Albany that was previously owned by the Union Pacific Railroad Company, but has been idle for decades. The lack of activity by the mill led to the creation of a community that became Crabtree, Oregon. Crabtree residents have complained about the safety of school children and of noise pollution in the mornings. The log loading and hauling operations run the risk of accidents. Robert Wielden, county planning director, stated that the logging operation did not meet county zoning codes. However, representatives from the railroad argue that they are governed by the Federal Interstate Commerce Commission and not county zoning boundaries. Wielden said that the operation was heavy industrial work in a light industrial work zone. The railroad said they are willing to negotiate their operations but will not consider relocation.
Nearly 4 months after Superstorm Sandy battered the East Coast, many residents with damaged property are still waiting for flood insurance checks. Officials such as New Jersey Governor Chris Christie blamed the delays on, quote, excessive paperwork, end quote, required by FEMA's National Flood Insurance Program.